I could put 10 grand with you that you could play with, and you're saying you might make me 12%. That's $1,200 in a year. But Chris, I could put 10 grand into my business, turn around and a few months later, make 20 grand of profit. So why would I put my money with you?
Yeah.
Well, you should be diversified. You should put all your eggs in that business basket there. Even though the truth, he had a truth, because the truth was my most profitable investment at the time wasn't my mutual funds. It was my financial advisor business. The business was the number one investment. If there's any advice I give you is one, always look at your business as the number one investment, but two, don't always reinvest all your money back into that business either. Like there is a point of diminishing return and you'll get caught in your own rat race for years and years. And I've seen that happen too many times where business owners make great money, multiple seven, maybe even eight figures a year, but then they can't stop working because they have nothing else to help them out.
Hello and welcome to the Chriswell Podcast on iCode Media. Today, I have a great conversation with Chris Miles, and we discussed, well, scarcity mindset. We discussed the idea of opportunities. We discussed things like how we think about money. I think it was a really fun conversation. It was fun for me to kind of think about money in a different way. And please enjoy our conversation. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast, write a review, share it with your friends, and support those who support us. Getting young presbyopes into progressive lenses can be tough, but it doesn't have to be. Varilux Liberty 3.0 lenses are an introductory solution for new and young presbyopes, and they are available in select ad powers. This lens provides all-in-one balanced vision for an accessible and great first-time progressive lens-wearing experience. Learn more about Varilux Liberty 3.0 lenses and get free resources to help start the progressive lens conversation with young presbyopes at slorpro.com/Varilux. My patients with macular degeneration want clear and succinct recommendations from me related to products and solutions that can benefit their long-term ocular health and vision. To do this for my patients, I need to be confident that what I'm recommending will have a benefit to them. And that's why my supplement of choice is MacuHealth. MacuHealth is specifically formulated and clinically proven to rebuild and maximize macular pigment over a lifetime. This results in enhanced visual performance and aids in the treatment and prevention of age-related macular degeneration. I've discussed carotenoid absorption on this podcast with Dr. Nolans and Stringham, and MacuHealth uses a patented process called micro-micelle technology. And this technology is clinically proven to increase carotenoid concentrations at the target tissue and deliver the highest level of bioavailability studied to date. MacuHealth has been great for my patients. We really feel like we have the ability to help those patients in all categories of macular degeneration. If you're not utilizing MacuHealth for your patients, check it out for yourself by contacting your MacuHealth representative. One of the things that interested me and made me want to have you on the podcast was I think I couldn't get an entire understanding of how your perception or experience with money differs from mine, but I don't think we completely align, although I don't think we completely disagree either. And I think that's interesting. And so kind of the goal of my podcast has always been to have interesting conversations with people I think are doing interesting things and think in a lot of ways differently than I do. And so what intrigued me was this idea of passive income. Although I kind of want to talk about banking too. So we're going to be all over the place because I think you kind of have some discussions on banking as well that I think it'd be interesting to think about. And then, and then also residual income. So first, Chris, thanks so much for being on today. And I wanted to kind of pick your brain a little bit about how professionals, so my listeners generally are business owner optometrists or associate optometrists. And there's some that practice in corporate locations as well, but kind of give me a perspective on passive income, residual income, and how professionals, business owners and professionals can use that information to sort of build the life that they want to have.
You bet. I mean, I kind of separate passive income and residual income as separate in my mind, right? Because they do get interchangeably mixed, you know, especially in the media. If you look at like mass marketing and social media, things like that, everybody's talking about passive income. But most of the time, it's usually about how do I work harder? How do I create another side hustle or business that's not really passive at all, right? So I put that more in the category of residual income. So residual income is more like, I see it as business income, right? But business income that can come from, you know, putting in the work up front, and then those systems can create a residual income coming in, you know, month after month, year after year, whatever it might be. And you're managing it, but you're not necessarily having to be the actively working it. You know, for example, if you're creating, you know, content, you know, where like, obviously I create a lot of podcasts and stuff. Someone says, hey, what if we took all that, transcribed it, put it into a book? Okay, yeah, that would be it. I mean, obviously a book doesn't get you rich necessarily unless you're J.K. Rowling, right? But, you know, you could definitely use that to create another stream of income within that, that you're not actively working for. Someone could go buy that at 3 a.m. while you're sleeping, you know, but again, there's that upfront work. Where passive income, I see that as your money making money for you, right? Your money works harder than you do. So passive income would be things like if I go and buy a rental that I don't manage, that's a key distinction there. Cause otherwise it's just going back to like almost more like residual income again, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, like where I have a property manager handling all the details and everything that's dealing with that. And I just get paid the profits after they pay the property management fee. For me, that's passive income. Or if I lend my money and I become the bank in a sense where I lend my money to somebody else at agreed upon 10, 11, 12 plus percent a year, that to me is also passive income, you know? So that's where I make a very clear distinction between really active income, which is like what you make as an optometrist, passive income, which is what your money does for you, and then residual income, which is income streams you can make in your business, but by putting systems in place so that you don't have to actively keep producing it.
Yeah. So I think that's really helpful. I think, you know, just to give you a sense of me, I've got a practice that's active income. And then I have obviously the podcast, and I have a kind of a consulting company, online education company that is, I would describe it the way you're describing it would be residual. It'd be residual income. And you know, I work hard in both of those things. And it's nice, as you say, it's nice to be home on a Sunday and you get notifications that somebody has purchased something or, you know, that sort of thing. But it is work that I continue to update and I continue to promote and do work on, right? So it's not really passive. And then, so when I think about passive income streams, the kind of the classic thought are, and you, I heard you kind of talk a little bit about 401ks on another podcast, but the thought is, you know, IRAs, 401ks, stock market investing, and then you have kind of real estate investing as well. So, the other side of, so I do have some of that, obviously, like we've been, you know, we've been saving and we don't put everything into IRAs or 401ks. I liked your approach with asking, you want people to sort of, maybe hedge your bet isn't the right term, but sort of, you don't want somebody who is all in on one investing strategy. When I first came out of school, I was met with by a guy who wanted to sell me whole life insurance. And I had just got done reading Dave Ramsey. And so I had about $110,000 of student loans between my wife and I. My wife was a teacher. And so we had about $10,000 from her and about $100,000 from me. And I'll tell you, like, in some ways, it probably wasn't the best long-term investing strategy. But that 2.5 years of me just eradicating, my wife and I just eradicating debt, I think propelled us into a couple things. One is good behaviors. Mm-hmm. And living on less than what we make. And we still do that to this day is like, I think one of the most powerful things that you said in another podcast that I listened to of yours was that, you know, as your income increases, passive or active, your quality or your standard of life might increase, but it's not going to increase commensurate with that other increase. And that's where I see people getting into problems. And so I say all that to say that, like, I have sort of moved away from thinking that Dave Ramsey is the best thing for professionals. But I think at the time it was really good to build habits and to eliminate debt, because I think at the time, had I tried to manage more debt, I wasn't ready for it. And so in any case, what do you think about that?
Yeah. Dave Ramsey is great in the sense of like getting started, right? Like someone who's starting from like, it's kind of like when you go to college and they say, hey, there's the, you know, math, you know, 105 or 1050, depending on what kind of college you go to, right? You know, that's basic algebra. Oh, but you're not quite ready for that. There's this also this 99R, you know, type of a class for, you know, really going back to remedial math. And that's really what Dave Ramsey is, right? It's like taking you back to the foundation. Like when it comes to being disciplined, like that's where he thrives. That is his special place. It's when you go outside of that, when it actually comes to how to create wealth, that's where there's a divergence between what he teaches versus what he's done himself and really what actually works. And so if you start there, like you start with like budgeting stuff, and even his debt stuff to some level works, even though I would disagree on some other points with it. But because, for example, debt-free does not mean you're free. If that were the case, I would not have all these Dave Ramsey poster children coming to us saying, hey, I'm not free yet, even though I'm debt-free. You know, like I still have 100% of my expenses were not going to debt. So therefore, even though I'm debt free, that just freed up a little bit of expense, but I still got everything else to cover. And I'm not really generating actual passive income to be able to cover all these expenses that help me become what we call work optional, right? Where you work because you want to, not because you have to.
Yeah. And I think that's the challenge I think a lot of people have is, I think one is controlling your connection with money better. And that's a big thing for Dave Ramsey, I think, for people with Dave Ramsey. But as you say, you can wipe away debt, and you're still gonna have to struggle with like, well, yeah, my debt might be gone, but I still owe taxes on my house, you know, I still owe I still have to feed my family. We still want to go on trips. I might want to, you know, I get a car, but I gotta save for that. So it's just always gonna be there. And so, you know, relationship with money, I think, is important from a standpoint of understanding what it does for you and what it won't do for you. And and obviously it totally buys freedom, as long as you don't, like we said, like as long as you don't increase, you know, your expenditures with your increase in income. But one of the things I wanted to explore a bit in terms of this idea of passive income. So I think those first two revenue streams have been historically relatively good on. The passive income stream is more about, you know, saving for retirement, or really the saving for when I'd like to be able to retire. I think to your point, I will probably always do quite a bit of work. Like I love what I do. I love, you know, I see patients 3 days a week, Monday through Wednesday. And then Thursday and Friday is kind of my flexible days. And that even turns in, because I like the stuff I do, it turns into evenings sometimes when my kids go to bed, or the weekend I get to be flexible. And so, so I say all that to say that I'm not sure. So I just bought land. We're building a building. That would be considered passive income in your mind?
It depends. You know, if you're actively managing that building, you know, even though your renter is a part of it, I would say it's more like a side hustle. You know, it's not so much passive. And now, from an accounting perspective, they're going to say, because it's rental income, they also classify by the IRS as passive income. Hmm. But I wouldn't put it in the category of I do nothing to get paid. Right.
Yeah. So because my business has to exist in that space to pay me for that. Is that correct? Or if I outsource that.
Yeah. Like if you had outsourced the property management, maybe you own the building, but you outsource the property management, now it becomes more passive. Now you're not worrying about how to deal with leases and things like that, and renters, make sure there's people in the other spaces outside of your own office. Right. And that's not a bad thing. If you choose to manage it yourself, that's not a horrible thing. Right. I mean, it's not like it's going to take up a crap load of time either, or it shouldn't, you know, as long as you bought a decent building. But there are, you know, there are definitely some things that where, you know, don't be under the illusion that I'll do nothing for the rest of my life and this is going to pay me forever. Right. Like you've got to, this is the key thing. And it's all about stewardship. Right. That's really what it comes down to. I tell people there's really three money mindsets. You know, most people just talk about their spender saver. Right. But understand that spenders and savers are both in scarcity, and you can never be truly free, emotionally free, if you're in scarcity. Because, for example, spenders, it's easy come, easy go, right? Like they keep trying to make money. They focus on the making of the money so they can spend it, but they're always having to keep hunting so they can eat their food, right? On the flip side, you got savers. Now, savers, they're the ones that are always heralded in the financial media as being the best people. And yes, they're disciplined. But the problem is a saver, at least in that perspective, can never save enough. They can never pay off their debt fast enough. It's never enough. You know, I was raised in that. And that's why I know that. Like even the Dave Ramsey mentality, I mean, it was easy for me to accept that one early on, because, you know, my dad was like Dave Ramsey's older brother that Dave Ramsey looked up to, right? My dad was like the most cheapest son of a gun you ever met. I mean, he was like, he would say he's frugal. We would all say, no, you're cheap. Like, badly cheap. But he saved everything. And that's all he taught me. He's like, just save everything you can, stash it all away, right? Like you got to have it for whatever. Well, understand that that kind of influenced me. I eventually became a financial advisor over 20 years ago. Did that for 4 years. And here's the problem is that as I was a financial advisor, I started to see some things. I started to see behind the curtain, right, of what was going on in real and really happening in people's lives. Not what you hear in the media, because, you know, obviously, if you go to the financial media, they're all paid for by the companies I work for, right?
But so, so let me. I want to dig into that. So the stuff you saw was essentially you have, as a financial advisor, you are getting compensated for programs or things that you're you are a fee based provider advisor, or were you a commission based advisor?
I was commission based, but studying to become a fee based at the time when I quit.
And so then,
so I was looking to do both. Right.
And then you were seeing that the people that you were advising and the advisors themselves were not, you know, getting any better in any of those scenarios. Is that right? Like they might have amassed more money, but they weren't really mastering that money well.
Yeah. Well, they were doing the same thing their clients were doing. Right. So we were always recommending our clients to stash it, set it and forget it. You know, you're in it for the long haul, you know, the typical stuff you've always heard. Right. But at the same time, you know, where's the evidence is what I came to realize after 4 years. And it came to the point with my dad. You know, I sat down with him, he's 61 years old. He says, can I retire soon? Cause I'm getting tired of this. I've had heart attacks. I've had strokes. I'm ready to be done. And then I look at his money after stuffing his 401k forever, getting the match, not paying his own match. Like some people do. If you're a business owner, he's getting paid a match and he's stuffing money away. And he was debt free in 18 years, even with his house. And yet it wasn't enough. I said, Dad, if you retire today, you better hope you die in 5 years. And when I realized that, I said, when he asked, well, what else can I do? I said, I don't know. You did everything right. And it came a few weeks later when I was talking to a friend that I trained to be a financial advisor, but then he went to go do real estate investing. And he asked me point blank, how many of your clients are actually financially free, Chris? How many really? Like where they don't worry about money. As I really thought about it, even the ones that were retired, even retired doctors and dentists and people like that, I said, well, they're all worried about running out of money if they live too long because they're trying to live on as little as possible, try to pull off from the stock market and hopefully Social Security can make up the rest. We're like, okay, Chris, so none, good job. How about this? How many of you guys as financial advisors are financially free? Not the commissions you're earning or assets under management, even if you're fee-based, right? None of that stuff, but actually financially free doing these investments. And at the same time, I couldn't find anybody that could do it either. Even the ones that were making millions of dollars as financial advisors still couldn't save enough to really be financially free.
Is that because they were spending too much?
No. Some of them weren't even spending that much. Some of them were dang cheap, you know? Now, they might have had a Lexus, but it was like a used Lexus, right? I mean, I was around a lot of guys that were that way. But here's why. And it's the same thing. You look at Fidelity stats. Fidelity came out with their stats last year. 45 million clients, only 810,000 have at least $1 million in their IRAs or 401ks. 810,000, that's less than 2%, roughly about 1.5%. But of those, Transamerica did a separate study and they interviewed people that had over $1 million in their accounts and said, you know, what's your belief about retirement? 35% of those with $1 million or more said it will quote unquote take a miracle to be able to retire. That means there's really only about a 1% success rate. And that's not even a success rate. That's just people that feel okay. They might be ignorant to that fact. And the reason being is because in the traditional financial world, if you're going to pull off income and you want to run out of money too soon, the number that's been proven to pull out is 3%, not 4%.
4% was from,
that 4% rule came from 1974. And that wasn't even a rule, right? People started, you know, using it that way because financial advisors said, oh, that sounds better, you know? But it's the whole, you know, Monte Carlo simulations now show about 3%. So if you have $1 million, that means you're living on $30,000 a year. You know, now there's always somebody that's gonna be like dirt cheap or broke, you know, in that sense, in their mindset, and then say, I don't need to do anything. I can live as cheap as I want. I don't have to go anywhere. I'm not even married anymore because I was too damn cheap. So those people, like, they can live on $30,000 a year, or they're like, oh, I live in another country. Like, there's always gonna be the people that will say probably on this the notes here, like, oh, come on, like I can live on $3,000 a month or $2,500 a month. Well, before taxes. Taxes come out at that $30,000 a year too, by the way. So you might live on $2,000 a month. So some people are like, oh, I could do it. Well, here's the problem. You have $1 million. You're a millionaire, but you're living on, after taxes, maybe $2,000 a month.
Yeah.
That's a broke millionaire. And so what's happening is, and here's the other problem. You get guys like Dave Ramsey, and I was this way too. I was a financial advisor saying you would make 12%. That was the average of the market historically, but it's not 12%. When I actually did my own numbers, looking at the actual S&P 500 and run the actual math right now on a good time period, I've run this for well over a decade, like months, you know, almost every month, it's 8.3% average. That's really good historically. Usually it's between 7 and 8. So it's not that high. And here's the other thing, Fidelity, I actually went to look at their actual target date retirement funds. I said, well, what are they doing? Because that's what 85% of millennials are picking right now. Well, guess what? Those target date retirement funds did 2.1% less than the average of the stock market for the last 10 years. So it underperformed the stock market, right? So if the some are saying average 8%, that means if you take away 2, you're only making 6. But that doesn't include the 0.75% fee that they take out too. That's on top of it, right? So when you have all those expensive 401k fees, you're lucky to make 5%. And the ironic thing is, even if you work for somebody else and you get a match, I find out when that match, when you compound it, the real 100% match, it's not 100% rate of return. Trust me, you put in 100% return on the calculator, you'll be richer than Bezos in 20 years. And I guarantee you will not be richer than Bezos from your 401k. But when you actually put it in, you really do the real math, it only adds maybe about 2 to 3% a year. So if you did 3% worse because you picked Fidelity's funds for retirement target dates, guess what? That match just made up for the poor performance. You would have been better off just being in the stock market. And that's the thing, is that everybody thinks they're going to get a higher return, but they don't. And then there's taxes. And then you got the fact of inflation. You can't even keep up with that half the time, right? So these are the things. You even mentioned too, you're like, hey, well, you know, as income increases, just live on the same. Well, that's great theoretically, but that's really hard to do in practicality because inflation makes us want to have to pay more money, right? That's a hard thing. Even if tax brackets, and by the way, speaking of that, even if tax brackets stay the same, if they just keep them where they are, well, just because you have to spend more money because of inflation will put you in a higher tax bracket. So why am I delaying my taxes to a later date? It's almost like the government wants me to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It comes down to like a lot of that. That's kind of what I wanted to talk about with banking, is it seems like this rigged game where, you know, I hate to feel like it's a game, but ultimately you're just like, sometimes I feel like, and I really like my accountant. I like to make him uncomfortable with different new ideas. But like, sometimes I'm like, do you work for the IRS or do you work for me? So the point about all of that is that I want to kind of dig into, it seems like this can be a game. I like the idea of being diversified, and I feel like generally I'm pretty diversified, but I don't think I fully have these, like you're saying, a truly passive income stream. And that's kind of what I wanted to dig into a little bit is, all right, well, does that just mean, in my mind, what I'm hearing you say is I'm going to have to take out some risk with purchasing properties, whether it's residential properties or commercial properties. I'm going to have to pay somebody else to manage those properties. Is that the only way? And then how do I understand that risk? Because I would think that, you know, obviously, like I came out of school and it was 2008 and everything had kind of was plummeting in terms of the housing market. I think that that's a unique situation, and I do think it kind of emotionally informs me, but I don't necessarily think that's the correct response, you know, just because I'm emotionally like thinking about, well, the housing bubble then is like a housing bubble in the future. I think I can control that a little bit, but I do know that there's this emotional pull. How should I be thinking about passive income? And also, you know, like, is this completely out of pocket income, or do you think that it's best to say like, hey, we go get a loan and that loan is 7% right now and we put 20% down? I mean, what does this all look like?
Yeah, so this is where it kind of leads into what I was talking about before, right? The scarcity mentality, because you have to change the perspective a little bit for it to work. Because there's the spender and the saver. And obviously my dad and I were savers, right? We were like Dave Ramsey, you know? But again, there was no freedom there. You know, the steward is where there's freedom. And a steward says, where can I have the best use of my resources, my time, my energy, and my money, right? Like, how can I use that better? And usually it's about income and cash flow, not so much about how do I store and accumulate wealth, right? Because if you focus on how do I have more money coming in, not just from your active work, which is good too, right? Like you mentioned, the true principle you mentioned earlier in this conversation was live within your means. That is a true principle. And it's not even a strategy. Principles and strategies are separate. You know, the principle is live within your means or produce more than you consume, right? The strategy, though, can vary how that looks. That's where, you know, when you hear guys like Dave Ramsey say, oh, the strategy is pay off all your debt. Well, that's not necessarily always live within your means, because the last recession, you brought that up, even if I was debt free, I was still in the hole every month because of, you know, different like business expenses that were happening with a new business we had launched in 2007, you know, and things like that. Debt free didn't matter. Like,
well, do fact, you know, for me, where, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. That, I mean, for me, where that trigger flipped was COVID. Yeah. So COVID completely flipped that trigger to me. Is like, so we had paid, mm-hmm. you know, again, like, I've always, and you're going to not like this, but, I've always taken 15-year mortgages out on our house. I was paying our house off quickly. You know, not a ton quicker, but a little quicker, where we would wind up paying it off in about 11 years instead of 15. And I had done all the things, you know, it's like I had 6 months of business expenses setting aside. I wound up, again, it was about 6 months that, when COVID hit and we recalculated some things, I was figuring out like all my other resources, I could have lived up to 2 years, right? I was like, okay, we can do this stuff with our money. We can watch this, watch that. And we had actually had about 2 years of expenses. And, you know, I said to myself, Chris, is like, this isn't enough. It's not enough. Cause I don't know how far, like, I don't know how long this is going to go. And so I thought, wow, would it be nice if I had extra. Again, this is probably scarcity, but had I had extra instead of paying my house off, had I had extra, maybe we could get 3 years, you know, maybe we could get, and maybe my house isn't worth anything. So that was the trigger for me. And oh, by the way, I want to keep my people employed. I don't want to have to get rid of them. I want to keep them as long as I possibly can. How much money can I keep paying them so that they can keep on board? And so immediately it was never enough. And that's where I was like, wow, I need to think about this differently. You know what I mean? And so anyway, I say all that to say, like, for you, it was 2007. For me, it was like we had done all the right things. I was in a good spot and it wasn't enough. When stuff really hit the fan, I was like, you know, and I was lucky because I had already had the podcast. I had already some other, residual income coming in where I didn't have to think about it as much, but all these things were, yeah. So anyway, that's kind of my story that's related to yours that really made me shift how I think about it and just looking for other opportunities.
Yeah. See that, and I learned, you're right. Like, I had to learn that same lesson too, because what I didn't mention earlier is that, and you probably know this because you've heard my podcast, but you know, in 2006, I was able to retire with enough passive and residual income that I didn't have to keep working anymore at the age of 28. So 2007, I came out of retirement, so to speak, to start teaching, educating people. I did that with another partner. And then, of course, the recession hit us hard. And despite the fact that I had passive income coming in and a lot of good stuff happening, I had thrown a lot of equity into my house. I couldn't get it back out when the recession hit because the banks wouldn't let you, right? Mm-hmm. And that was a big epiphany to me too, because I had taught, you should have reserves, and I had reserves. But what happens when those reserves are gone? And what happens when you have a higher payment that you committed to because you think, oh, I can just, you know, worst case, I can always refinance later. Because I was a mortgage broker in 2007. I thought, I'll have no problem being able to refinance my mortgage. There's always a way. They'll give it any mortgage with somebody with a heartbeat, not knowing they could change the rules on me. And that's where I realized that actually having equity was dangerous. You know, just, I mean, it's not bad to be debt-free. Don't get me wrong. Like, that's not a bad thing. But what is bad is not being liquid enough. And even more importantly, not having additional streams of income coming in case 2020 says, you know what, your business is no longer essential. You know, we're going to tell you, you have to legally shut down, you know, and you're scrambling trying to figure out what to do. And you mentioned something earlier too, that was interesting. And this is all part of the same conversation, right? Because this mindset has to shift, you know, for example, being diversified, right? Most people, I mean, I taught this as a financial advisor. In fact, I remember even telling this to my brother-in-law, who was a business owner, just like a lot of you guys are. And I remember him telling me, he's like, well, Chris, I could put 10 grand with you that you could play with. And you're saying you might make me 12%. That's 1200 bucks in a year. But Chris, I could put 10 grand into my business, turn around and a few months later, make 20 grand of profit. So why would I put my money with you?
Yeah.
Well, you should be diversified. You should put all your eggs in that business basket there. Even though the truth, he had a truth, because the truth was my most profitable investment at the time wasn't my mutual funds. It was my financial advisor business. The business was the number one investment. If there's any advice I give you is one, always look at your business as the number one investment. But two, don't always reinvest all your money back into that business either. Like there is a point of diminishing return and you'll get caught in your own rat race for years and years. And I've seen that happen too many times where business owners make great money, multiple seven, maybe even eight figures a year, but then they can't stop working because they have nothing else to help them out. And so when I diversify, I actually try to diversify among multiple asset classes. Because remember, a mutual fund is not diversified. Even just today, someone had posted on Facebook saying, hey, well, this Magnificent Seven, right? The top seven stocks, which by the way, two of those seven are Google. So it's really the Magnificent Six, you know, the Magnificent Six companies have about 27% of the S&P 500. It's weighted towards the bigger companies. They're all tech based. That means if the tech industry tanks, regardless of what the rest of the stock market might look like, even if the rest of the stock market is fine, you will lose money. You're not really diversified when you're in the stock market. And it's always the same asset, which is a paper asset class. And notice that every financial advisor you talk to is always about paper assets. Doesn't matter if it's mutual funds, annuities, life insurance, you mentioned that, right? You know, even whole life insurance is a paper asset. Savings accounts, bank CDs, stocks, bonds, options, all of those are paper assets. Notice that all the advice you're taught as a, you know, by a financial advisor or anybody in the financial world is to buy paper assets, right? That's it. Even bonds. Think about it. You could lose money just like in 2022. This happened in 2008, 2000, well, not 2009, but 2008 it happened, where stocks and bonds both lost money. But they're supposed to be where, you know, I thought it was supposed to be where bonds and stocks are supposed to be opposite of each other. So if one loses, the other makes money. That doesn't happen. Not in reality. So everything's paper assets, but there's real estate, right? I mentioned real estate and there's various forms of that we can talk about in a little bit here too. There's also commodities like gold, silver, oil, things like that. That's a separate commodity. And I don't mean when I talk about gold and silver, buying the exchange traded fund, right? Buying the paper asset version of it. I mean the physical hard stuff, right? Just like when I buy real estate, some people ask me, well, if I buy a REIT, a real estate investment trust in the mutual fund world, isn't that like real estate? Not even close. You have no asset backing you up. Zero. It's all paper. Nothing is real.
I don't understand any of that. So I understand most of it, but I don't understand the real estate, the REIT. I didn't understand that. Can you explain that?
Yeah. It's basically a company that buys a whole portfolio of real estate, but the real estate doesn't have to be profitable. They are literally, I mean, they did this actually in 2021 and 22 a lot. They're just throwing real estate in the portfolio, even though they would overpay for it, right? Like BlackRock. I mean, that's another famous one that everybody's like, wow. I mean, I had friends that were in real estate saying, hey, if you can sell a BlackRock, do it. They'll pay 20% more than the actual appraised value. So they are buying literally upside down properties, you know, and they're putting it into their portfolio because why? The government printed so much money. People are like, what do I do with all this extra cash? The government keeps throwing me cash post 2020. What do I do? Oh, I'll throw it in the stock market. So they were just finding places that really throw money away, right? So you don't really own assets. You really are owning a copy of a copy. If you ever watched the movie Multiplicity with Michael Keaton, I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, but in that movie Multiplicity, he makes clone copies of himself, right? But at one point, the clones made a copy of the copy. The clones made a clone of themselves, and that clone was an idiot. So in any case, as a result, you know, it didn't work. When you buy real estate investment trust, you are buying a copy of a copy. You're not buying the actual assets. You're buying something that has its own price independent of whatever those assets are doing. So even if real estate goes down, you could make money in that REIT and vice versa. If real estate even goes up, you could also lose money in that REIT as well. So that's kind of the big difference between that, you know, having a REIT versus having, you know, having the actual real estate asset, the actual tangible physical object that you could actually sell or cash flow or do whatever you do. So that's different. That's paper. That's why it's paper asset. It's just a copy of a copy. Like, you know, it's like a clone of a clone.
The most common questions I get include, what ophthalmological codes or evaluation and management codes should I use? What ICD-10 codes do I need to bill with this CPT code? What CPT codes can be billed together and what can't? And my favorite, How do I manage a patient who has diabetes who comes in for a quote unquote routine eye exam? These questions really highlight the confusion and uncertainty that serves as a daunting hurdle for providers, makes it more challenging for them to care for their patients and provide those patients with the best opportunity for a lifetime of ocular health and clear vision. That's why we built iCode Education for this specific purpose. Our mission is to provide optometrists with resources to help you understand disease states, revenue cycles, and billing and coding so that you can put that on autopilot and truly care for your patients. Check out iCodeEducation.com. That's E-Y-E-C-O-D-E education.com. We've developed a premier billing and coding bundle that includes all of our billing and coding resources in one place. We also have a 10% discount code just for listeners of this podcast. Enter the coupon code EYECODEMEDIA22 at checkout. We'd love to work with you. Check out iCodeEducation.com. I want to discuss the MyDay toric contact lens for a minute. When I'm reaching for a daily lens for my patients, I need to know that it will be available in parameters that I want and it needs to work. This improves my chair time and my patient satisfaction. The MyDay toric features the same optical lens design features as the most prescribed monthly replacement toric lens on the market. MyDay toric now completely mirrors the Biofinity toric's parameter range. To be clear, if you find the parameter in a Biofinity toric, you can find it in a MyDay toric. This toric lens design is multifaceted to ensure optimal visual acuity, lens stability, fit, and comfort. Its uniform horizontal ISO thickness and wide ballast band quickly orient the lens for better performance and simplified fitting. The MyDay material is CooperVision's softest one-day silicone hydrogel lens and features Aquaform technology combining a unique balance of high oxygen permeability and natural wettability. The result is a highly breathable lens that keeps our patients' eyes looking clear, white, and healthy. So if you haven't started utilizing MyDay toric in your practice, I'd encourage you to reach out to your CooperVision representative to get started.
Yeah, let me take more of a money twist with that, because of course it applies to every area of your life, right? And he's totally right. You know, Tyler's right where he talks about where, you know, you have more than enough and to spare. There's always more than enough opportunity. You don't have to get in at the ground floor of an opportunity, right, for it to work out. Like, the timing's always here. It's always now, right? There's always enough time. There's always enough opportunity. It doesn't have to be a scarcity of it. Now, in the money world specifically, right, I look at it as that stewards, which is the abundance mindset around money, they're not gamblers. Understand that we've been taught and trained and educated to be gamblers. For example, high risk creates high what? Reward, right? What a load of BS, first and foremost, right? Because if that were the case, every one of us should stare at the solar eclipse without sunglasses. You know, or without any protective eyewear, right? Which sadly people did. They even thought it was a conspiracy too, because there'd be no reward, right? Because I can see it with my own eyes, you know, not through some filter, you know. Or like, how about this? If I take high risk with my health, right? Like if I want to take high risk, I'm going to go eat at McDonald's every single day. I'm going to supersize myself, right? Or high risk, I'm going to, you know, if I take high risk in my marriage, what's going to happen there? Take high risk with my teeth and not brush or floss my teeth. What's going to happen there? Notice that every time you take high risks, you'll lose it. If you take high risks with your money, you'll also lose it. When is a high risk? Risk, the definition of risk is chance of loss. When did a 90% chance of losing become a 90% chance of winning? It never did. It never did. The reason you're taught that is because financial companies don't ever want to take the risk. If you invest more like and this is really a good example of stewardship and abundance mindset, focus to invest more like the bank does. More like the banks, because the banks, they don't put money in the stock market. They let you put your money in the stock market, even if they're the house that actually goes and does the transaction for you, right? But it's not their money. It's your money they're investing. They take their guaranteed fee off the top. That's where they get paid. So of course they're going to tell you, hey, keep it in there for the long haul. Set it and forget it. And you know what? And pull off less than interest only. Why? Because their cash flow, their profits will increase year after year as you do that, because more and more money accumulates as assets under management, right? Well, banks don't invest their money in the stock market. They don't believe in high risk creates high return. They know it's low risk creates high return. If they want to take high risks, they would have said, hey, where's that person with that 500 credit score? Let's give them a mortgage. Oh yeah, we'll just charge them higher interest. That doesn't matter if you don't get paid your money back, right? You want a return of your principal, not just a return on your principal. So what I find in the world is because we're taught and trained, because there's literally billions of dollars of marketing going in to teach you to invest with these brokerage houses like the Fidelities and the Merrill Lynches and people like that. The problem is this, that you're taught, hey, the 401k is safe. That's what everybody does. That should be the place to go. And you're diversified, right? But here's the problem. When someone tells me, they say, well, Chris, I've heard your stuff about real estate investing, but I'm more of a conservative investor. I don't like to take high risk. So that's why I put my money in the stock market. And I laugh. I was like, honestly, you're the biggest gambler I've ever met because you actually think what you're doing is safe. Like, I put my money in things that has a real tangible asset. What real asset do you have? What claim do you have? Do you think a couple of shares of Apple stock you have is going to do anything? Do you think that Tim Cook's going to take a break from his busy schedule and say, oh, you know what? I should listen to Jimmy here about what he has to say about Apple, his ideas. You're not going to do that. And someone will throw out like, well, what about Warren Buffett? He's a stock investor. No, he's not. He buys businesses. He is a business owner. And yes, he owns shares, but he buys a majority interest or control so that he can at least be on the board of advisors to control what happens inside that company, brings in his own team to make sure he safeguards his investment. Do you have enough money to do that? No, you don't. You're just literally riding waves. You're gambling your money, hoping and praying it's going to work out. So with real estate, you can be a gambler too. Where are gamblers in real estate? It's the people that say, I'm going to go buy the property in my backyard. You know, like, it's like somebody said, buy real estate. So I'm just going to go buy it. Not knowing anything what you're doing, right? You're just doing it blindly. The sad thing is that if you're going to do anything blindly, whether it's stocks or mutual funds versus real estate, you'll probably still become a millionaire doing real estate because you can still be an idiot and make money sometimes. Yeah, so a lot of people can accidentally become millionaires buying real estate, even if they don't do it right, you know, because it is a real asset. It does appreciate over time regardless, and also has a much higher leverage. There's a lot higher returns in real estate. Now, as a financial advisor, I always told people, well, don't buy real estate. I mean, other than your own house, because you can buy your own little rental, but you know, they only appreciate 3 or 4% a year. So I was always looking at the value of the home, right? And I would show them charts. If you've ever seen those Ipsen charts where it shows you like, here's if you put a dollar in 1928, here's what it is in 2024, and you're gonna have tens of thousands of dollars or $100,000 doing that, where real estate, you might have $1,000 or $100 or something like that. So buy with me, buy stocks, you know, invest with me. Well, here's the thing I didn't count on. And this is what I learned. Like when I started to take the red pill, the matrix red pill, so to speak, and I started to learn more about real estate and I left being a financial advisor. The one thing I realized that there's a whole lot of other factors. Well, one, I don't buy in my backyard because you might buy a property that's horrible. For example, I live on the western half of the United States. Western half of the US is really, really bad. They have high prices, low rents. So that rent to price ratio is not very good. But if I buy over in the Midwest or Southeast, I have better prices, better rents, and I make a better return on my money. You know, even with the high interest rates, if I buy with a mortgage, I can still usually make at least what's called a 6% cash on cash return. Meaning that if I put $50,000 down on a property, I should still make at least $3,000 a month profit, even if I have a property manager. Right? Even that's after all my costs and everything, still walk with that 6% profit. But what else can happen? Because what if that $50,000 down payment is a 20% down payment on buying a $250,000 house? Well, here's what happens as well. One, that $3,000 is tax advantage because I pretty much can depreciate the property and keep about all of my money. So where someone makes 6% in the stock market, they still have to get taxed on it, regardless of what kind of investment you do other than a Roth, right? And even then you're using after-tax dollars. But at the other time though, there's also appreciation. And if appreciation happens, I get a 5X multiplier because I only put 20% down. And I remember hearing this the first time from a real estate investor when I was a financial advisor, and it blew my mind a little bit. I would try to discredit it because he would say, you know, going away from this 50,000, let's go to simpler numbers. Say that you put 10% down on a $100,000 property, right?
Right.
Well, that $10,000, let's just say that $100,000 property appreciates 10%. That means it goes from $100,000 to $110,000 value. Well, you didn't just make 10%, did you? That $10,000 now with that equity, you just made another $10,000. You made a 100% rate of return. Because why? 10% makes you that 10X factor. Well, 20% makes you 5X. If it were $20,000 down and went up 10%, I didn't make 10%. I made 50%. That $20,000 now increased by 10. So that's the one aspect that I didn't quite understand as a financial advisor. There was multiple returns that I didn't realize I was getting. I was thinking so, you know, two-dimensionally about investing in money that was like, you put your money in the stock market, you make a return, that's it. But it's like, no, you can actually make multiple returns. And that does include that the renters actually pay down your mortgage for you. Because even if I make $3,000, that does include the fact that in that scenario, actually, you would probably would still have the payment go down about, you probably increase about $3,000 of equity too. So even though you have $50,000, you might still make 1.5% that first year, even if you didn't appreciate. So even if there's no appreciation, if you make 6% plus another 1.5%, you're still making 7.5%. And so that's where things kind of blew my mind. In fact, yeah. I'll give you an example. 6 years ago, I bought a property in Tennessee, and it was at that time, you know, it was about roughly about a 12% cash on cash return, meaning that I put $32,000 down. My monthly cash flow was about $315 a month. But as time went on, also my rent payments also went up too. So that profit kept increasing, right? Also, there was some appreciation as well. So what ended up happening is that my $32,000 made about over 300% return in 6 years. That same $32,000, if I had it in the stock market, in the S&P 500 to be specific, would have actually been worth about $65,000. I would have made almost 100% return in 5 years, which is still amazing. The stock market doesn't normally do that. But think of it, like I actually made triple the money with less risk because I still had an asset that was backing me up. The market could have easily gone down. I can't do anything about it. If something goes wrong with the property, like say, for example, a renter stops paying, you evict them, get a new renter, right? Those kind of things, even though there's risks, still you can manage those risks much easier because you can call the shots. So that's
a
different mindset.
How do you go about finding somebody like who understands that specific market so that it is completely passive? Mm-hmm. You know, because I mean, what are you looking for, and how do you know which property managers to look for, and who's going to do the you know, the background work to know if I put my money here, it's going to be a good investment as opposed to my backyard, that's going to be a bad investment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I first started doing real estate, like in 2006, like I was the cheap saver mentality still, not quite the steward yet. So I was trying to manage it myself, buy my own backyard or use my starter home, convert it to a rental and all that kind of stuff. Right. And that's fine. You can do that strategy too. But again, there's limits to it. Now, if I buy a property, I don't have to go hunting for a property. I go to what's called a turnkey real estate company. They call them turnkey because literally they have, and they're usually in certain areas of the country, certain pockets where they'll specialize in that area. They find the properties. You already know what you're going to make up front before you even buy the property. They help you get the financing for it. They'll even property manage it for you. They'll pretty much do everything for you, right? You just have to go through and buy the property and then collect the net rent checks. You know, that's what's left over.
If they know how to do all that stuff, why don't they just buy the properties themselves?
Oh, they do.
Oh, they will.
A lot of times they'll cherry pick their own properties, but they'll have more opportunity than what they'll buy for themselves. Or they've already just done enough and they're like, I'm fine. But they realize that because people keep saying, well, can you help me buy a property? They'll often, it depends on the company. Sometimes they'll charge a fee to go along with the sales price, you know, or they'll find it for cheap and then they'll basically flip it to you at more of a retail price, right? Or closer to retail. So they might buy it dirt cheap, they'll renovate it, and then they'll sell it to you. So sometimes they're just flippers, real estate flippers, that are selling it to you, but then they'll also have, sometimes they'll even have a property management aspect to their business too. So they'll have a flipping, you know, business, and they'll have a property management business. So they're able to double dip off the same transaction, right?
So let's say this goes wrong. So again, I want to explore you know, so you go in, you do this, and you have a turnkey, you know, real estate agent, and they do all the math. They show you all of the build, and you can make say, yeah, okay, this is $300 a month in passive income. Mm-hmm. How does it go wrong? If it fails, how does it fail?
Yeah. If it fails, it usually is one of two things. The two biggest risks you're going to have is one, a bad property manager, right?
And what would be a bad property manager? They don't collect, they don't fix. What does that really look like in your experience?
Yeah, it usually is mean, one, they're not very good communicators, for one. Two, they put in bad tenants, right? Because you might put in a bad tenant that also they're not have a good propensity to pay, and then they're trying to scramble to find a new tenant, evict them, and get somebody else in, right? That's a good example right there. So if they don't screen tenants properly, that could be bad. So in a turnkey real estate model, I think the biggest risk is make sure you have a good property management. Do they have good reputation? Do they actually have a good way, you know, a good track record of placing tenants and having tenants stay even, right? That's a big thing. I'll tell you my two worst turnkey properties I had, I just sold off last year in 2023. They were both in Alabama. The property manager, although they started out well, pretty soon we noticed that there were some issues. Now here's the thing. This is why stewardship is so important, right? Because you can be very passive. And I turned over to my wife, said, here, why don't you take care of them? Because you're basically, we're running all the income through you so we can have you buy properties on your credit and I can buy properties on my credit. We can kind of have a force of two-pronged approach of buying more real estate. Well, she kind of ignored it. She didn't even look at the numbers for about 3 years. Well, eventually we started looking at the numbers and saying, wait, we should have made more money than this. What we found out is that the property manager, it wasn't the company itself, but the people that was assigned to the property, again, because we weren't watching it, we noticed that there's all these extra expenses coming out. This woman was charging us for things like stains on the driveway left by the tenants. You know, the reason she did that is because she rented it to her son and his friend. So she was passing on some of these expenses to us because she was pretty much just trying to save her son some money. And they were always paying late every single month too. That was the interesting thing. I mean, we always got paid, but they always paid the late fee, but, we noticed that there was some, you know, little shady things going on that we only made about half the cash flow that we expected. We eventually just fired them. You know, we got rid of the property management company and we sold them, still made a profit. So I still made a 40% return on those properties in 3 years, you know, despite that horrible thing there. So usually,
so property manager is one way it goes wrong.
Yeah. One way it goes wrong. Property management. Yeah. The other way it could go wrong is if, you know, we saw another 2008 happen, which doesn't happen very often where real estate values actually drop during a recession. The last six recessions, it only happened once. Now, if it does do that, if you still have cash flow coming in, it doesn't matter. And that's also why having a down payment is important too. That's why, I mean, you're always required to put at least 20% down anyways. That gives you a little bit of buffer. So it's pretty rare you'll ever see your property drop below that. Oh, here's another key tip. I don't buy properties that are like McMansions. I don't buy luxury properties. I buy, at best, average properties. Because even in the last recession, even when real estate values were dropping, the lower priced homes weren't dropping. In fact, because people had a downsize, they were all buying the lower priced houses, driving that market up. So the lower priced homes actually increased in value, where the higher the price of the home, the more the value it tanked. So yeah. I also learned, like, in a specific area, don't buy the most expensive house in the area.
Have you ever experienced problems with, because I know, you know, I've got people I know who, and most of this is in the cities you would expect it to be in, but like squatting. So people coming in and they stop paying and then you can't get rid of them. Is that all incumbent on the contract that you have with the property manager where it's like, look, you got to get them out of here. I'm paying you to get them out of here. And if you aren't doing that, I mean, how does that all work? Is that a potential risk?
It is a risk. The squatter is a state issue. So for example, I had,
having breakfast with some friends the other day.
Yeah. It's the states that allow it. Right. Exactly. Like that's why Chicago, I mean, there are people that love doing real estate in Chicago, but I look at Chicago as like a huge HOA and I hate HOAs, right? Like they suck. Even for your own house, they suck. Well, Chicago charges a lot of taxes. They have a lot
of issues. Shed in my backyard and a chain link fence.
That's right. Yeah, you got to do everything by them. And that's the truth. Like you want the landlord friendly states, which sadly, not to be political, but they're usually the red states, where the blue states are the ones that you have to be worried about, right? Like California, Oregon is a good example. I had a client that has Oregon properties, rentals. She's like, oh, they're great. And they have lots of equity. I said, yeah, but somebody could squat in that property. You cannot evict them because Oregon law will not let you evict those people. They have to live there until they move out and destroy your place.
Oregon is exactly where it was. I got a buddy that I was having dinner with him last week and he said he's got a warehouse in Oregon and he's got squatters in there that have brought in coolers to use as bathrooms and then they just store them in that and he had to spend like $15,000 to clean up with a hazmat people to clean up after he finally was able to. It's crazy.
Oh yeah.
So anyway, sorry. So you're looking for mainly red states and you'll look specifically on those states that you're purchasing in that you have the right to evict people. And it's not going to be that challenging to get rid of people who aren't paying their bills.
That's right. They're landlord friendly states. They actually do allow you to evict people quickly, you know, and even states that are quiet, like don't go for the hot tips. Like you always hear about Phoenix, Arizona, you know, Texas, all that stuff. And there are pockets that could be good, but I look for the boring markets. I look for, because to me, boring is sexy, right? I like things like Arkansas that nobody ever thinks of, North Carolina, there's Oklahoma. I mean, there's a lot of states like that that are very landlord friendly. They'll let you evict in after 30 days, you know, and they'll support you in that. And so those kind of things are much, those kind of places are better if you're going to do rentals. But understand this, is that, you know, when we talk about passive income, and I know we're running short on time here, that's why I'm kind of wrapping it up a little bit. But I mean, rentals, I mean, they're one aspect, but they're such a minor aspect of what I learned was the whole gamut of real estate investing. Mm-hmm. It's like, for example, I mentioned you can lend money to real estate investors and they pay you a contractual interest rate, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, for example, I had a friend who said, I need $50,000 for just 3 months until I can close to sell my apartment building. I said, all right, great. How much? I'll pay you 15%. I said, awesome. Sounds great. Lent him the money. 3 months later, got my money back plus the 15% per year prorated for those 3 months or so. So like I made money off that, right? I can lend money to investors and not be the investor myself. One of my best investments right now is raw land, where I have a partnership where those guys are buying and selling raw land to people, but they pay us like we're the bank. They pay us on terms. Like they get a loan from us rather than having to go to the bank for that raw land, which is hard to do anyways. And then they pay us.
Can you do fractional reserve lending?
Can you do fractional reserve lending? I'm sorry, say again.
Do you have the rights on those things like banks have with fractional reserve lending?
Exactly. You got it. Yeah. So yeah, I'm basically acting like the bank, right? Where they pay me payments. If they don't make a payment, if they foreclose on me, if they default, we can foreclose on them and then we sell it to somebody else, usually for a higher price than what it was worth anyways, or what we got it for in the original contract. So there's things like that. Like I put in $400,000 in that partnership so far. And even though they're doing all the work, I'm still making about $9,600 a month. And that's increasing every single month, you know, that we're buying more land. I mean, there's the oil and gas. You can buy oil and gas, you own the land and you get paid royalties. And I'm not talking about the speculative drilling stuff. There's a lot of that out there. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about where there's already wells being drilled and they're already producing. Like the oil is already there. They don't have to search for it. It's not a gamble necessarily. You just have to wait for them to pull the money, pull the oil and natural gas out of the earth, which is a green energy, pull that out of the earth. And then you get paid the royalties on that. You know, you get paid on franchises. You can do car washes. There's so many different ways that I never knew was available that pay you so well and have so many safeguards in place. It doesn't mean that's 100% efficient, right? Like you buy apartment buildings, you buy self-storage units. Those two things got hurt the last couple of years because of interest rates, right? And affecting their values. Yep. They went down. Yep. You know, so you got to be careful about which ones you pick and choose, but you can diversify among that whole real estate asset class and be very well protected. And so that's where I put a lot of my money, is more business, real estate, even commodities, and a little bit of paper assets. You know, like I have my infinite banking policies that I use to hold cash, where I get paid more than the bank and it's tax-free.
Yeah, well, that's, I was hoping that we would get to that one too, but I want to be respectful of your time. So Chris, Tell everybody where they can find you and how to get a hold of you. And I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, you can always go to moneyripples.com. We have lots of education there. Or you can just look up our website or our podcast, Money Ripples Podcast, on YouTube or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Awesome. Well, Chris, thanks so much for doing this. I'll probably have to figure out a time to have you back on to talk about the, what did you call it? The infinite banking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Do a part two.
Well, thanks so much.
That's a whole nother animal.
That's awesome.